Okay, so today we have the great pleasure of hearing from Leroy Field. Leroy spoke to us almost a decade ago here, actually, September 18, 2002. And just by way of introduction, I'd like to read first of all a little bit about his early life and then about his accomplishments, which are also here on the screen. So this is from an interview that was done with Leroy. Published in the Canadian Well Construction Journal, an interview about his background and his involvement with the Canadian Association of Drilling Engineers. The question was, tell us about yourself and why you chose a career in the oil industry. Leroy's reply was, I was born in Consort, Alberta, in 1931, the son of an Alberta wheat pool grain buyer or elevator agent. We moved to Bowden, where I grew up. I was a pretty good hockey player. Got to attend the Boston Bruins training camp in 1948, played junior in Lethbridge in Calgary, and then played for the Edmonton Mercurys until I got hurt. I stayed in Edmonton with my uncle, who was next door neighbor at that time, being a party chief for Highland Exploration. This is how I got into the oil patch as a jug hustler on a seismic program in Oyen. Also worked on a General Petroleum Rig number 8 in Oyen in midwinter, when they needed somebody to fire the boilers. I would work seismic in the days and the rig at night. I'm setting a high standard here. I made it to Cat Edman after spending 2 years in drilling. And after that, I went back to school to do engineering. I graduated with a degree in petroleum engineering in 1954, this being only the third graduating class of petroleum engineers from the University of Alberta. I became a professional engineer in 1952. And I guess from a historical point of view, it's important to realize that a lot of the big educational programs, and it's equally true on the geological side, that we have in Alberta these days, are not really all that old. You know, a lot of times people got educated down in the States and had to come back up to Canada. So the establishment of engineering facilities at the University of Calgary and Alberta is fairly recent occurrence. In terms of what Leroy accomplished after he joined the patch as an engineer, the areas he's worked in have included the Grand Banks and the Beaufort Sea, deep, difficult, and sour foothills wells, heavy oil pad drilling, slim hole, and transportable by anything rig operations. He completed 25 years with Amoco in various capacities, culminating as drilling manager. Since 1989, he has been providing engineering consulting services for drilling operations. He's been a leader in developing new technology procedures in the drilling business and has been providing training in this discipline throughout his career. I mentioned the article, and we can make available to you the reference for that if you'd like. And in 1974, Leroy was a founding member of the Cade organization that I mentioned. With that, Leroy, I'd like to ask you to come up and introduce your talk today entitled Drilling Then and Now.
As Chris says, this evolved from an interview with Kate and worked with different things at 74 and CAODC. And they're just twins. I mean, they're tied together. Kate, you don't talk about Kate without talking about CAODC, Canadian Association of Oil and Drilling Contractors. For a start, I'd like to introduce my two daughters. They surprised me by showing up. Yeah, that was quite a surprise. So I hope I can satisfy them in my performance. I think you'll get a little more about me because I have really put my own view graphs on. Evolved from this interview, we talk about drilling then and now. We talk about operations. Then and now. I'm only going to go back to about the 50s, and because that's where when I got involved, and not back to the old cable group. And so we'll go from there of all the developments that is associated with myself and a lot of other people in this room have been associated with, and they all relate to these experiences. But anyway, after many years of trying to find steady work, I now find myself here with a job as an historian. Never thought I'd do that. However, I've realized that there's just no future. So we're going to start with that. And I kept running into situations where I got returned to drilling. And I just couldn't get out of it. And, you know, as my first job of helping inside me, I ran through all the jobs they had, and it always seemed to end up back on the building right there with the water hauler. And, well, that's where I got started. So at the tender age of about 18, I'm thrown into this oil business, and I haven't been able to get out one way or another. But, I think most of you realize that we're very privileged and have been privileged, hopefully in the future, that have the cohesive nature of an oil field activity headquartered here in Calgary and Edmonton, and all facets of the industry, from exploration, seismic, drilling, all activities were shared and working groups working within those, including with the government on regulations and environment. It's a unique situation. Having worked with Amoco and worked with the different departments in the United States headquartered in Houston or Denver or wherever, they never did this sort of thing. They didn't join together. And from that has evolved a great deal of advancement in all facets, learning from each other and working with the government on regulation. I think I got to give a big accolade to the explorationists. We spend their money, the drillers spend their money. It's a hate-love relationship. Production department's not so bad when we spend their money, because they're pretty understanding. And we seem to know what we're doing there. But they've borne with us for years. The only problem I have with explorationists is that they come and ask for cost estimates that are low enough so they can get their well. And then when we overspend, it's our fault. And not only that, the second thing I've got a problem with is that they'll find locations that you wouldn't believe we have to go to and drill. It's been a great association, and like I say, a hate and love relationship. The industry itself, every time you see something, I don't care whether it's a new technology or just news in the business of oil, in any way, the icon, the poster boy, is a rig. And so we're up next to doing up the connection and everything, and that's what's showing. This is the radio, right? And so that's the basic, because we have to get down where all of the production is. And that's what the rig does. And the romance of the thing, for example, is precision drilling down in Chile, drilling a 36-inch hole, boom, come in late, boom, they're down. I mean, it doesn't matter where it is. So, you know, we want recognition now with this group here, you know, finally. So anyway, we've had a lot of working committees, and I'll just go through some. The Arctic Petroleum Operator Association, way back. How can we drill on a permafrost without damage? How can we get there and handle it and that sort of thing? We developed those working practices. Kick control, so we could have all of our people trained. The Petroleum Industry Training Service Center set up to train people in H2S, drilling, servicing, you name it, of an issue that will affect the industry. As a result of the famous infamous Lot 4 Boulevard, we have developed the upward recommended practices on how to drill in sour gas environments, and the application process of the government in, if you're going to drill a sour well. Again, Shell has gone through it again down at Beaver Mine. But these were all set up. And so you, like my father used to say, there's got to be a better way to learn what to do properly without making mistakes. But it sure gets results once you do make that mistake. So we'll go from there. I'm not into the computer technology where I could bring my laptop on. You know, I just can't handle that yet. It's getting beyond me. So what I'm going to do here is go through some vignettes. You heard about the Hawaiian operation. That was pretty tough. And I remember pulling a drill some test on, I think it was a general petroleum rig 8 that just outside Hawaiian, and the salt water was free. And I said, that's it. I'm going to stay inside here. I'm not going to do this rig work. Harry McQuaid was the driver, and he says, look at it this way. That's going to be the worst tower you ever had. I should never listen to that. another job I had was Joffrey Waterfront. And I'm just relating to these various things I got called in, or new people that were involved with them, just to kind of get you to relate the things that you think about, you've been involved with. Anyway, the Joffrey Water Flood was a three-way operation flooding the Carnegie. I think it was the first water flood in Alberta. Anybody else?
What year was that?
54 or something.
Wasn't that the Viking?
Or 58.
Oh, Viking. You're right.
Yeah. I do hope you will keep on correcting. I hope you will.
That's why I'm asking, but we did water flood in Turner Valley in about 56.
That might be before, but they were flooding this very thin Viking in three units, so I ended up with Great Plains doing the calculations on the water flood and advancing the water flood. Shortly after we got married, December 30th, 55 years ago, Marina and I went in two vehicles to my trailer parked in Edson, working with Messina up in Windfall, which is solid timber and clay mud. And that's where she kind of got broken into the industry. I don't know why we're so married today. That was a time. But that was Bean Operation Three Way Hudson Bay. Anyway, we drilled this Windfall Discovery well, and we were trying to test it with, and Hudson Bay insisted that we use this double extra heavy 2-inch pipe from the wellhead to the separator. And if you have any relationship to double extra heavy 2-inch pipe, the hole through it about like that. You know. And it was middle of winter, and Ted Bob up at Bostown in Calgary, and he says, you've got to get a 4.8 well on this thing. And we kind of staggered through with high grade formation, blowing the pot valve on the separator. ESG guy and myself in the middle of winter.
Yeah.
It wasn't an effort. Never again. Of course, Shell got a lot of experience with these guys back then, but that's quite a while ago. And so I, the rest of my time up there at Quinn Falls, I was going in with the old track vehicle, pump RC, and a little track vehicle. And going in and pumping alcohol into the wellhead to freeze it. Because all summer, we get up to 3,000 pounds pumping up the alcohol. Got involved with a Hercules fly-in. Of course, when we worked up in the north in the early days, we were building airstrips and flying the rig into the Hercules. And somebody was reminding me that they could have a 40,000 pound boat. And on the Richardson Mountains, we also drilled a well in the town of Inuit. We built a pad and tanked out through the dry hole. And that was quite an experience. Red Earth, drilling with air, lost circulation area, the remote area. There's a lot of knowledge the industry here in Canada has applied to drill in Arctic environments. We drilled the well, Tony Vandenberg ran out at that on Axel Fiber, 600 miles from the North Pole. And, I think Bobby got involved in a well on Spitsbergen Island in North Norway, way back when. So we pioneered the northern operations, and we pioneered the ability to drill and not damage the area and the environment. And there's a lot of people get credit for that. Amoco got involved in Point of Mountain. Dave here was an exploration geologist. I don't know if you were responsible for that, but he was assistant that we drill on the top of Point Mountain, which was, what, 1,300 feet above where we had our airstrip. It was sort of like going around and around and around. And that was a discovery, and that was a great gas field. Beaver River didn't turn out so great. The fractures, water, but that was all flying and stuff in the air. And north, that was Northwest Territory border to Yukon in that area. We had a lot of operations in the Muskeg, and we understand that you don't go on the Muskeg except in winter. Of course, now it's called the Boreal Forest. I don't know how it got that name. We always called it Muskeg. We had helicopter operations. Amoco took a farm in, can't tell you who from, north of the Primrose Bombing Range, Conklin area, and they were to drill 70 wells in 2 years. Well, we need all the shallow rigs there were to go in 2 winters. So we worked with the drilling contractor, and we developed, I've got pictures over here, by the way, 4,000 pound load helicopter transportable rig. We had three substructures, so we moved from one empty substructure to the next. We kept two rigs going there, and we drilled 30 of the wells, and we drilled them cheaper than we drilled the winter well. So, you know, these balls. Yeah. Getting down to some practicalities. In operations, we worked with our drilling contractors, CAO, DC, and we worked on, and their operators and committees and so on. And we standardized the drilling forth, so that everybody kind of knew what they were getting at those giving. And we got the horse blanket kind of standardized, and then we started the daily drilling order, morning report. All of you people probably understand what that is, where we got to report in the morning. And we standardized that. So what that allowed us to do with the standard horse blanket, so to speak, and the drilling wire, is we can now collect data, uniform data, and we could work from that. We also developed the first satellite communication from the well site, and we trained our people to put the data into the computer and send it by satellite, so we got our morning reports right from the well site right now. And that was a long time ago we did that. We did remote monitoring of drilling. We're talking about an evolutionary process. The last well was drilled in Colbert by Joel Mammoth, who I've been in Mercer. We sent the drilling data right from the rig by a satellite, which is that elevation we're damn near to the North Pole, so to speak. Quite an accomplishment to get the signal down. And we monitored it there with a 24-hour monitoring operation. And we brought it right into Calgary office. And we developed safety procedures as a safe kick control and training facility. And I've got a little procedure we worked on as a unit. We did offshore kick control. We did training for the Grand Banks offshore, and we had an apparel well, a golden spike that we did training, and then it's Petroleum Industry Training Service. You can take a kick, an actual gas kick, and learn how to handle it. And all of our certification of rig crews, drillers, drill butchers, even rig hands are going through the drilling rig operations, the service rig operations, the kick control, and we get certified in handling all the rig and equipment. You know, everybody knows that the driller sits there and rotates to right. And a lot of it looks the same on the surface. But there's been a lot of unitization and saving on rig moving costs and so forth. You take one of these 15,000-foot rigs, would have 40 loads initially. But by unitization and using the cranes and by the connections on the substructure to the derrick and so forth, we got all of the work done there so that the price comes down for the exploration hole. And we've just been involving cost savings in just about every facet. This TPA rig, Jeff Williams made that rig on 4,000-pound load. And so you could haul it on a one-ton truck. You could, of course, haul it in a Hercules. You could haul it by helicopter. And so he had a job just off of Yellowstone National Park that flew in and set right down. And of course, we had it, he had it go by ship here, by rail of the ship to Spain, Europe, all of Spain. So there was quite a bit of evolution involved in that. But we'll get to basically the evolution that I was talking to Dave Martin, our explorationist here, wondering why we never got anything out of that guessing when we were drilling it, and now they're going back and finding stuff that we did. And what we used to have in the old days is a designation of solids that we were drilling out was sand, or shell, or silt. So we we developed with API a solids analysis, and with a coding machine we got for particle sizes. So then we started working on how can we get these small particle sizes out of the mud instead of re-drilling. This is really holding us up. Also, we have to disperse the mud so that we can handle these solids and it would still flow instead of getting impossible. We got a polymer system, and the polymer would give us the viscosity, and we got into solids removal equipment, and we got into handling the surface volumes with hydrocyclones, and the big deal was to get into big volume decanted centrifuges. So nowadays, we can get the solids out of the mud. We have a polymer fluid system without clay particle that we put in to handle it. And we have decanted centrifuges, and so we have locations out there on the prairie where we go in with no disturbance, no sump, and I have some pictures here in the 35 millimeter, which I'm not going to get to show today, that's another time, where we you can't tell we were there. And so this evolution of drilling fluid system did a lot of things. What it did is allowed us to use hydraulics at the bit. And so we got big bigger pumps, more horsepower on the surface, so we could get a lot of more jet velocity. And so we now are drilling a lot faster. We evolved bits from no steel bearings to steel bearings, and now we're into solid state. There's no bearings. And you can put solid state bit in and damn near drill your whole well with it. So these are things that have happened. Drill screen connections. Quality of the steel, so it's not embrittled steel for hydrogen sulfide. And we have the coil tubing working, mostly sort of doing the completions on the horizontal drilling. And the biggest thing, I think, is the remote servo motor downhole, say offshore, or down where you and the hydraulics on the rig. And we had a committee that you pit us, upstream petroleum industry trading service on safety, where we could get the spinner wrenches on the drill pipe with hydraulic. We had seals finally that could hold the hydraulic pressure. We got top drives, and so the hydraulic drive has revolutionized the handling of the drill string and the handling of pretty well everything that's on the breakdown. I can't tell you why those hydraulic operated ball preventers in that Gulf blowout wouldn't work, but it was a real step forward to drilling 5,000-6,000 feet of water. Both on self-positioning drill ships that hold their position without anchoring, or you can anchor, that's it. And hydraulic lines, and they operate with everything down at subsea. So hydraulic development is a big thing. I'm changing. Determination, I went at that. As we go through all of these procedures, I've had one guiding principle. If at first you don't succeed, destroy all evidence that you tried. Work well, you can destroy all evidence. Anyway, we went through solid determination, we went through polymer mud systems, we went through solid removal. By the way, they're using the big volume organic centrifuges on settling ponds, and then they can use a flare burn off the excess, and they just end up with a basically very consolidated solid. They also use oil affinity polymers to grab onto the oil skins. And so they're evolving technology, but you know, it's pretty tough at $20,000 a duck to hope they put the money to the proper use. That takes me to this horizontal drilling technology evolution in the past 10 years. I gave this talk quite a while ago. And I was project engineer with Gentex, Paulson Group, and Amoco, where we worked together and developed the first measurement while drilling tool, which allowed us to take surveys without the wire line stopping drilling, stopping circulation, getting stuck in the hole, to where we could pressure pulse the tool, and it would open and close the side port, and circulation up with the horizontal would tell you azimuth and information. That's progressed today, where that's all done electronically. We were about 30 feet behind the disk and above our bending moment to drive it. They're at the bit now, this little survey tool. So they're right there. And I went to a talk the other day, and Kate is still going and giving talks. And this young fellow gave a talk about what they're doing in horizontal drilling. And they're going along at the top of the Carnium out there, and we're heading in flood. And they're just taking the Carnium, you know, less than 10 feet where they're at. So they're at the top, and they're getting surveys as they go along in the top part of that formation. And they're running gamma log and helo right there at the bit. And you can tell where they are and what type of research they're doing. And it's just blows the mind what they're doing. They're going up with multiple laterals. Of course, steam assisted gravity drainage, where you got two, one putting steam in, and the other is a production well. They're doing multiple. Up in the forest below what you mine up there. And that's the future up there. It's not mining. Most of this work will be done through the years in some surface steam assisted gravity drainage and other technologies with solvents and steam and so forth. So it's just been great feeling to be associated with and still involved. I went consulting for quite a while. My forte, again, learned by experience and mistakes, was horizontal drilling and making applications for wells that are going to be drilling sour gas wells. And my problem is that I'm really behind the technology. These young people are still progressing, cutting costs, and doing things you wouldn't imagine. I don't know what the longest horizontal is now. Well over 10,000 feet. Now, by the way, excuse me for using old units. 3,000 plus meters. You know, my life, I mean, it's just, like I say, it really blows my mind anyway. Just an aside, people are getting a little bit sleepy after this. I thought it was a bit unnerving that doctors call what they do a practice. I thought that kind of related to what we have been doing all this time. I don't know where I picked that up. Probably rental, because a lot of it. Anyway, I used to have a talk, I don't know what happened to it, but I called it The Romance of Drilling. And I talked about the places you got to go and the things you got to go that other people don't go to. They don't even know how to get there. But I blame the exploration guys. Man, they do send you into damnation. And it seems like that's where the oil and gas are supposed to be. But now we come back. Exploration is allowed to drill again. They tell we sit there. Yeah, it's missing. Anyway, this romance of drilling is kind of interesting, thinking about nice places you get to go to and the camps that you own. Oh, food in the camps, you know, it's great. I quit drilling for a while at Permeator Corporation. I don't know whether that was on there. But that was the completion tool. And that took me to Swan Hill, trying to negotiate a cat trail only at night that the trucks would run over it, for home oil running this Permeator. A Permeator was a completion tool. So I'm not a drill here for a while. I'm on the drilling race, but it was how can I explain it? We used to fabricate these at the Oil Lake Machine Shop in Turnabout. And they were the only one that had a furnace that would handle 15-foot casing tubes to a heel after the welding. And so we used to fabricate these, and it came from Chicago, Chicago Food Company. What they were a three-section telescope. The three-section telescope collapsed within the screw mounting pad. We drill a hole in the casing, we weld on a mounting pad, we stress relieve, we screw in the permeator. It was held collapsed with an aluminum screw. And when we ran the casing, we would pump down some acid just on the, before the cement part hit. And that acid would eat away. The pressure would blow the permeator out to the wall. And the acid would eat out the center aluminum screw. So Myron Zanimer, I had in this article, the most unforgettable character I have. I think he had about somewhere around 100 patents to his name. And he was out in Turnabout, 30-some. You might have heard of Myron. He invented this permeator. And so I became a salesman. I'm up in Swan Hill. Howard Whitecroft are running these permeators on Swan Hill. And the advantage of that was you didn't have to perforate the casing and shatter the cement because these were telescoped up when the cement was wet, eaten up from the inside with acid. And then you could use a ball sealer that had air entrained into the ball that was the same specific gravity as acid. So you could crank a ball in, pump a barrel, crank the ball in, pump a barrel, and it would go on the path of least resistance, plug off. Well, with Swan Hill, they were unitizing on the best 10 feet of the pay, the floor of the floor of sun. And these permeators run across the whole thing. They're costing them a lot of money, and they weren't getting any credit for unitization. But I have some charts, which are now down at Turner Valley. And Monica here has a display down there, if she'll ever get a chance to put it out, of these permeators. And the stimulation record that would go from a couple of hundred pounds per square inch pressure to 4,000 psi. Just bam, 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 bam. Anyway, we're talking about romance drilling. I ended up in Algeria, of all places, running the east for the French oil company Krebs in combination with Shell. And they, by perforating in the stone, and I think it was a couple of hundred feet of limestone or dolomite, they were getting about 10,000 barrels a day at about 200 psi pressure. And when they ran the permeators across the whole section, they were getting something in the order of 50,000 barrels a day. Of course, that puts us kind of to shame. But the problem was that our shearing didn't go quite the way it was supposed to go, so some sheared out when we were doing the cement job and rotating or reciprocating. And not only that, the drillers hated them because they had to position them. And the geologist hated them because he had to come up to the well and tell them where to put them. And it was a hard job. I didn't laugh too much because I told Myron what was going on. I did some tests to show that his permeator was not perfect. So we fired him. I went on from there. Anyway, I had to bring that on in. Anyway, that was rewarding time. And the industry is not the same as today. I was privileged to be in it when we were growing and dynamic. But the environmental industry has got a hold of everything in the oil business now, and we're all happy. But I'm hoping that logic will prevail, and we can get on with doing what we should be doing. Innovations do keep coming. Don't despair. And we're going to be amazed at what we can do. So the petroleum history can look back on the past. So the future is yet to come. And it's a good association because as it develops, we can keep looking back. So anyway, with me, after having to find a niche for these many years, I'm retired. But anyway, I find I'm a perfect fit for the job. Thanks for your attention. I've got some pictures over here. There's a plant rig. I wanted to show that a little bit. There's a picture of me on the beach on the dome where they stored the ships. What was it called?
McKinley.
Yeah, McKinley Bay. They dug it out themselves. Sand just off the side of the desert. And so they put up this palm tree down there. One of the other experiences there is a rig that goes from its proud erectness to a pile of rubble was the rod pole blower. And the hearings on that, I don't want to go through that again, please. But we did learn a lot from it. What else I got there? Helicopter operation.
Leroy, do you think the governments are working together with industry as well as they did a few years ago?
No. No. One indication of that is for example, I had a consulting job cleaning up locations or doing environmental audit, imperial oil cleanup location. And at that time, there were ERCB employees in the field office. And the people that were restoring the location would be in communication and talk and say, if this is okay, if we're doing this right. have a look. They were all sold out. And the rule was, you know what the regs are. You conform to them. If you find these errors, you're going to be fine. So that's an education. Now, I don't know what it's like today. Because you went ERCD, EUV, and then they found out, hey, electricity and oil fuel don't mix, so it might be ERCD and EUV. So I don't know what the communication is out there. Anybody here can tell me?
I think it's still working, it's all regulated.
Yeah, the other part of the case. Horizontal drilling, as I say, was a great breakthrough. So now they're out there fracking vertically, okay, section vertically, no section, no section.
Oh, yeah.
Small fracking, yeah. And they're encountering the fractures that are in the rock. The question, the second, and so, yeah, we can contact them. And people are doing that. And they're doing the thin zones in the cardium, like I mentioned. And they do all that. Now, the question you asked, second, was, are these fractured gas fields, are the fractures sustainable? In my day and age, when we got a fractured zone, we leave it off and then continue drilling. That was the kind of fractures I was used to. Up in the Beaufort Sea there's a lot of gas that come in under high pressure, and we bleed it off and carry on. Do these fractures sustain themselves with a reservoir adjacent? And or is the gas in the fractures as it migrated up and ended up in the fractures of the shale? I can't tell you that. Now, anybody else that's an exploration geologist want to deal with it, but of course, fracture gas is what flow and depression gas.